Not Brother Steve, Brother Smart Guy. Brother Randy. I asked Brother Randy, I said, do you guys want to hear a short, boring sermon or a long, good one? Randy and Billy both said, how about just a medium-length, excellent one? And so, sorry. You're out of luck today, so... We're going back to a series we did for about six Sundays, the issues of our day, and we stopped doing it because I got hung up on this one, and I'm going to go past it on the list because I didn't know quite how to address it. I wrote, I don't know, lots of pages about it. I wrote one whole draft of it and sent it to Steve Fair to read and see what he thought about it. And this is yet another iteration of it, and I'll give it to you this afternoon, and then we'll move on to other subjects. The issues of our day. We have many issues of our day. John R. Rice said that every generation has to write about the issues of their generation, even if it's a readdressment. And you have to keep on readdressing things in arguments. And this afternoon, I want to talk to you about conservatism and Christianity. Conservatism and Christianity, subtitled Conservatism and Christianity, Close But Not the Same. Keep that in mind. Close, but not the same. There are similarities between conservatism, those views, and Christianity. Conservatism is defined as this by the Oxford English Dictionary: the holding of conservative principles, the tendency to resist great or sudden changes, especially in politics. It's an adherence to traditional values and ideas, sometimes opposed to liberalism. With that definition, it's easy to see how connections are made between Christianity and conservatism. The Encyclopedia Britannica defines, says this about conservatism, quoting, conservatism is a political doctrine that emphasizes the value of traditional institutions and practices. Conservatism is a practice for the historically, is a preference for the historically inherited rather than the abstract and ideal. This preference has traditionally rested on an organic conception of society, that is, on the belief that society is not merely a loose collection of individuals, but a living organism comprised of closely connected, interdependent members. Conservatives thus favor institutions and practices that have evolved gradually and are manifestations of continuity and stability. Government's responsibility is to be the servant of the people, not the master of the people. It's to be the servant of existing ways of life. And politicians must therefore resist the temptation to transform society and politics. This suspicion of government activism distinguishes conservatism not only from radical forms of political thought, but also from liberalism, which is a modernizing anti-traditionalist movement dedicated to correcting the evils and abuses resulting from the misuse of social and political power. Therefore, it's easy to see that there are connections between conservatism and Christianity. And we can see it more clearly now when you have these things defined. And they're similar because Christianity, like conservatism, is something that's married to a fixed set of ideals that are not unchangeable in the realm of conservatism, but they're constant. They're steadfast principles by which you make decisions. So Christians, we are devoted to living by not an abstract view of life. We live by what? By the words of God. These are something we've received in a traditional form from our fathers in the Christian faith, and we have it in the form of God's word. Conservatives also live the same way with adherence to something else, not the Bible per se, but to the Constitution of our United States or the traditional ways of traditional forms of government. So conservatism is devoted to the promoting and preserving of the principles of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and Christianity is devoted to the Scriptures. And so because both are devoted to a fixed set of ideals, it's easy to see how conservatism and Christianity, sometimes people forget that you can be a conservative and not be a Christian. You know what I mean? And we also tend to forget you can be a liberal and be a Christian at the same time. possible. The differences. To be a conservative, this is the differences between conservatism and Christianity. To be a conservative does not require that you adhere to every level of conservatism. There are people who are moral conservatives, and then there are those who are fiscal conservatives, and then there are those who are both moral and fiscally conservative. In the conservative camp, you find quite a bit of diversity. Many conservatives are what I would call nominal Christians, Christians who are Christians in name only. They go to church, they have a church membership, they have an affiliation, but we wouldn't really view them as Bible-thumping Christians. They're Christians in name, nominally, but not in practice. And then there are conservatives who are not Christians at all. But to be a Christian demands and requires absolute adherence to certain fundamental principles or doctrines. You cannot truly be a Christian if you deny the deity of Christ, the blood atonement, salvation without works, and the resurrection of Christ from the dead. We could probably add a lot of other essential doctrines to what it takes to be a Christian, but I just want to point out to you that in Christianity, there are certain non-negotiables. Now, here's a for instance. When I was a kid growing up in the 80s, in the late 80s, my mother and father started listening to Rush Limbaugh on the radio. You guys ever heard of Rush Limbaugh? Ever listened to him? Okay, so in the 80s, at 11 o'clock every day, my mom flipped on the radio, and while we did our study, I was homeschooled, which explains a lot, and so while I was doing our studies, we would have Rush Limbaugh pumped through the house while we were learning 2 plus 2 is 4, and 7 times 7 is 56, and 9 times 9 is... I thought it was 108. I always get that confused. But while I was learning my ABDs and my 1-2-4s, I was hearing Rush Limbaugh coming through the radio. And I can sing, when we had the Gulf War, they had the little parody song, "Oh, bomb Iraq, oh, bomb Iraq." If we sang, "What's a dual turning into fossil fuel?" "Bomb Iraq, bomb, 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 bomb Iraq." All these... you guys never heard that before? Isn't that a great line? "If Hussein wants to duel, turn him into fossil fuel, bomb Iraq." And it was based on the tune to Bob Iran. Pop Bob Iran, you guys know that one probably. Now, all these little songs, Ahab, the Arab, and all kinds of weird things, all the parody. And I heard Limbaugh all the time. And my parents were down with his view of conservatism, and that was a kind of the post-Reagan era, right after Reagan has come out of being president. We had George I as president. And so my conservatism, as I was learning about it, that Limbaugh was a conservative. He talked about conservative ideals. All the way into my early teen years, my parents listened to him every day, 3 hours a day, every day. I heard it, all of it. At some point, I figured out that Limbaugh was not a Christian. Now, he makes a claim to be a Christian, but really when you thought about the things he said and the things he did and then the lifestyle he lived, not a Christian man, conservative, an American, a nationalist, a capitalist, but I wouldn't call him a Christian. So you can be a conservative and not be a Christian, just by example. To be a Christian demands that you believe certain things. In the conservative movement, which is typically and primarily Republicans, of course in Arkansas we had our Democratic senator, what was the guy's name from Prescott, the pharmacist? Mike Ross was a Democrat, and I think that they had a special name for them, Blue Dog Democrat, who were conservatives, but they were Democrats. And usually it's a Republican. But in that group, you have a whole spectrum of people. Just to illustrate the spectrum of conservatives, of what conservatism is, we can start with the top. We can start with President Donald Trump, who some people say is just a conservative in name only. So he has the nominal conservatism title. All the way down to our Oklahoma senator, James Lankford. James Lankford is a Bible-believing Christian, an ordained Christian minister. Got his master's degree in divinity from Southwestern Theological Seminary. Was the director of the largest Christian camp in the world, Falls Creek. And so, Bible-believing Christian. So they're both in the same Republican Party, same conservatism, same conservative ideals. Although quite a spectrum between the two. Lankford is committed not only to the highest ideals of Christianity, but also to conservatism. That kind of diversity is what you have in politics, in the political realm. But that kind of diversity is not meant to exist in Christianity. You can have a big spectrum of ideals that are important to you or less important to you in conservatism, but in Christianity, there are some things you have to believe that are non-negotiables. We call them fundamentals of the faith or cardinal doctrines. In Titus 3:10, it says this about Christianity. A man that is an heretic, after the first and second admonition, reject that man. So in Christianity, if there's a person who claims to be a Christian but refuses to believe certain important doctrines and who's schismatic in his views, if he's been spoken to warmly and conscientiously twice and will not change his views or change his beliefs to match the scriptures, the Bible says, reject him. Put him out of the fellowship. The Apostle John, that's a pretty narrow view. Paul is saying, if they won't be corrected, then be done with them. Whereas in conservatism, you have a range. Nobody gets kicked out unless they want to get kicked out. It's more roomy. The Apostle John wrote this in 2 John verses 10 and 11. He says, if there come any unto you that bring not this doctrine, the true doctrine of Christ, receive him not into your house, neither bid him Godspeed, for he that biddeth him Godspeed is partaker with his evil deeds. Here John says about the doctrine of Christ, if someone has a false doctrine about Christ, his false view of Christ, you can't even say, have a nice day, God bless you, lest you be partaker of his evil deeds. So Christianity is very narrow. We can see the threshold for fellowship in Christianity is a very high threshold. And we need to remember that conservatism is not the same as Christianity. You can be a conservative and not be a Christian. And I wonder if we need to be reminded, I think I put this in there, I've already said it, but we need to remember that a person can be a liberal and be a Christian as well. Now, conservatism, sometimes we say, well, conservatives are, President Obama kind of summed up what he thought conservatism was, people who are dumb and cling to their guns and their Bible. That's kind of the way he summed it up. Well, I wonder if us, as us who are like we all are, but conservatives, we tend to think of liberals as what? Well, we don't want to say it out loud. They lost their mind. You know, we can't believe. So there's a spectrum. There's extremes on both sides. We have to remember that a person can be a liberal and be a Christian. And I don't know anybody to point out to you that would fit that category. I'll tell you somebody who claims to be a Christian and a liberal. You tell me what you think about it. Hillary Rodham Clinton. Chew on that. And her husband, who is a Baptist. Chew on that. probably the most prominent person who probably is really a true Christian, from what I can know about him, would be, we were talking about him earlier, back there. Because we talk about, ladies, what we talk about back there, if the world could hear what we talk about, the world would be a better place. Because we solve all the world problems right back there in the foyer of the church. Isn't that right, brothers? It would be Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, a liberal and a Christian. Number three. This is three for me. You don't care about numbers, probably. The church is in politics. The church is in politics. When you get to talk about politics, every Christian is involved in politics in one way or another. Every Christian is. But those of us who are involved in leadership in churches or have the oversight of churches or in the church business, you might say, we have to think about how the church, individual churches or the church in a generic sense as an institution, is involved in politics. Now, from the 4th century forward, there has always been what I'd call a political Christian church in the world. I say 4th century forward because I'm talking about the Roman Catholic Church, which begins to see development in the 4th century. Prior to that, prior to the political Christian church of the 4th century, religion and politics were always married together. If you were a member of the Nation of Israel, politically, in order to live in the nation of Israel, when Israel had its own nation in the Bible times, what religion did you have to subscribe to? You had to be a Jew. You had to be a Jew to live there long term. Otherwise, you had to get out. If you lived in Great Britain in the middle 17th century, you had to be a member of the Church of England. In fact, to show you how even some things are still, religion is still a barrier today in the United Kingdom, you cannot be a king or, what was Churchill's thing? Prime Minister, if you are this religion. Do you know what religion it is? You cannot be king or prime minister if you belong to this church. You know what it is? It's a Catholic church. You cannot be prime minister or king of England, queen of England, if you're Catholic. These things still exist in the world today in the 21st century. Tony Blair famously converted to Catholicism after he was no longer prime minister. He was married to a Catholic, and he wanted to become Catholic, but he couldn't do it while he was prime minister, so when his time was over, he swapped over. So politics and religion have always been married all the way down through the world. In fact, D. James Kennedy said in a sermon, this is going to be a sermon from the mid-90s, that there has never in history been a truly secular nation. There was never a truly secular or non-religious nation on the face of the earth until 1789 to 1799, when you had a thing called the French Revolution, where they decided to be totally secular, and their efforts to do away with God totally, they changed not from a six-day work week, but to a 10-day work week, because they wanted people to stop thinking about going to church. They wanted to get away from a church, from a God-ruled nation. And if you've done any reading about the French Revolution, you know that was a bloody and horrible time in history. In fact, some of the, I don't want to get into that, it's a side issue. But the rise of the Catholic Church created a church-state power that ultimately shows us a Christian, quote-unquote, church that's married to the state. And when that developed, this church-state religion, this Christian church-state religion, if you opposed the state or opposed the church, you became an enemy of both, which led to probably 1,000 years of persecution of Christians who did not want to belong to that church. So for 1,000 years, you have a corrupt church, then you had pure churches. And this corrupt church, down through the ages, persecuted all forms of dissent. And this persecuting manner that they had revealed that church was not at all the Church of Christ, because the true Church of Christ doesn't persecute anybody. The true Church of Christ is not trying to establish an earthly kingdom. We're concerned about a spiritual kingdom. Now, when the Reformation period began, the corrupt church, the Catholic Church, which was, a reforming of the Catholic Church when the Reformation period began, the corrupt church was weakened by the rise of a less corrupt church. We'll call it Protestantism. Catholicism, Protestantism. This lesser evil called Protestantism still wanted the church and state to be wed and still wanted dissenters to be enemies of both the church and state. So it was just on a lesser scale, just about different matters. In fact, in the world, it was not until 1636 where there was a place where the law said you could be a dissenter from the church or Christianity and not be at odds with the state. And that was a place called Rhode Island, 1636. In fact, in America, there were only two states that had true religious freedom. And that was Rhode Island and Pennsylvania, established in 1681. The founders of those two states, William Penn and John Clark and Roger Williams, were people who had been persecuted because of their religious opinions and practices. And what they decided to do was they wanted to have states or places where you could be sure that the government did not and would not ever create a marriage between church and state. Because every time the church, in an institutional sense, weds the state, it gives birth to a child called persecution. Every time. Every time. We were talking at lunch, and I guess one of the guys that's running for governor is a Baptist preacher. And I told somebody, Billy or Sharon told me that we had a Baptist preacher running for governor. And I said, well, I ain't voting for him. He said, you wouldn't vote for a Baptist to be governor? I don't know if I would or not. Because is he going to get carried away and want to make everybody a Baptist? And Baptists are kind of hard-headed and narrow-minded. I mean, that's a side issue, too. I'm not getting into that. But on some things, I have a very strange sense of what's right and what's wrong. Okay, it's the right sense, but it's a strange one. I bring this up because we need to consider how involved the true Christian churches should get in politics. Should individual churches marshal their resources and join the political fight? Is that something that should happen? Should the churches of Christ become grassroots political activist training grounds to try to change the country through the churches, through the political process, by getting churches to work together? Now, that's a question you need to consider. And the answer, in my opinion, is no. The Church of Christ is not called to be a political agent. The Church of Christ is given a commission by Christ himself, and his commission is to preach the gospel to all creatures, baptize those who believe it, and teach them all the teachings of Christ. The Christian church is not a political organization in the sense of like governments. We're a kingdom and a kingdom business. We're expanding through the preaching of the gospel. The churches of Christ are not commanded or even instructed in the scriptures to form any kind of government at all. In fact, our government in this country is something that's based on Christian principles, and it works very well, but our country has problems now because in our founding era, America was much more Christian than it is today. And as America becomes more and more less Christian, the right application of Christian laws to non-Christian people is causing problems. It's causing problems. Just by way of example. I don't want to get into that either. I'll save it for later. That's something I do to keep you interested. You see what I do? I bring it up and I say, I'm not going to talk about it. Because it causes you to be frustrated. And it makes you wake up and and think, why do we need this guy anyway? Well, I'll say this. Think about this, about equal rights to all people. You think the founders of our government, the founding fathers, do you think that they wanted the Bill of Rights to be used to permit, to validate people's mental problems? So if you have a girl who says she's a boy, or a boy who says she's a girl, you think the founding fathers gave us the Bill of Rights to allow those people to get rights to continue in their self-deception? But that's how we're forced to apply it, because those rules were created, that thinking was for a Christianized people. And if the country is less and less Christian, you can see how it causes a conflict. That's Christianish nation. And we're not Christianish anymore, really. When Obama said that we're no longer a Christian nation, you know why Obama could say that? Because as he looks at the nation, does he see the overwhelming signs of a Christian country? No. So he sees the country has declined, drifted from its original principles. And as we drift further and further from the scriptures, the country will drift further and further away from the Constitution and the right application of these laws. And it's kind of sad. Now, does this mean that the individual Christian should not be involved in politics? Well, that answer is no. Individuals are free to get involved in anything that they want to. In fact, it is through individual Christians that we see the political church. These persons, everyone who's a member of Bethel Baptist Church, goes out and lives their life, conducts themselves in a way that reflects upon this church. You take the teaching you hear here and go out and live it out in the culture. So in that way, the church is political, but through its members, not through an official participation. The Christian who is taught the Word of God takes what he learns and goes out into the world, salting and shining the light as he goes through life. The individual Christian enters politics and attempts to lead in that fat capacity by the principles and teachings of the Scriptures. Now, the decision to get involved in politics is not something for the weak of heart, because as a nation is sliding more and more into the quicksand of secularism, where the only thing you can be sure of is that you can't be sure of anything, the Christian who's in politics will be pulled and crushed by their efforts to govern lawfully in a way that honors the Lord Jesus. Which brings us to a crisis. Now, I'm not sure sometimes if there really is a crisis in the world or the times, or if the media is just trying to make everything look like it's a life or death. You know what I mean? The press, they love it. The post-election protests of 2016... in 2017, were basically huge temper tantrums thrown by people who didn't get their way. And if you watch the news, the media, they made it look like the whole country's in an uproar. But what you had was a very small segment of America. I mean, a very small group of America who dared to show themselves in such an immature and childish fashion. I mean, the whole thing is immature and childish. When you go to Walmart and you see some mom and some little kid says, "Mama, can I get this? Can I get this?" And mom says, "No." And the kid throws himself on the floor and throws a fit and knocks stuff off the shelves and screams and hollers. Do you think, well, that kid's got a point? Is that what you think? Is that what you think when a coworker, someone you work with, throws a fit because they don't get their way at work and knocks the stuff off their desk and kicks a trash can? Do you think, oh, yeah. It's silly. It's silly is what it is. I need to remember that next time I throw a fit. I am being silly. Big temper tantrums. If there ever was a time to see the future of the country, it was that time. Because it'll be some of those persons, the tantrum throwers, who will one day be in power. And it kind of shows you what a country looks like when it's led by people who are ruled by their emotions and not by logic, not by rational thought. So I don't know if there really is a crisis in America about some things that wasn't already there or it's not just a growing trend. There will always be problems that come up, and really, the folks, the worst place to get your information is television news. And I say that because the news is all about ratings, all about ratings. I want to read you something from Thomas Jefferson from 1807 about the press, 1807. Here's what Jefferson said. "Nothing can now be believed which is seen in a newspaper. Truth itself becomes suspicious by being put into the hand of that polluted vehicle. The real extent of this state of misinformation is known only to those who are in situations to confront facts within their knowledge with the lies of the day." There's so much false teach, so much deception. Have you ever seen a news story and they have a clip from somebody's interview? In fact, this happened a few years ago to Dr. Al Mohler. He was interviewed for CNN. CNN interviewed him for 25 minutes. How long? 25 minutes. The clip that they showed on their program was only 2 minutes long. And it was crafted in such a way to make it look like he was saying something different than he said. And here's what he said. This was striking to me. When you go for an interview with CNN, I don't know if you're compensated for it, but I think you are compensated. But when you interview with them, they make you sign a disclosure that says, "We are free to use this interview in any way that we want to make any edits that we want to, and all edits are final, and we are the sole owners of the content," meaning you can't get a copy to show the full interview. Now think about that. You want to be interviewed and put on the news by somebody who says, "You say whatever you want to say, but we control how it's perceived." Now think about that. That's why when you see Mohler on television shows, or people like John MacArthur or anybody else who's an evangelical leader, they try to be as direct as possible the whole time about matters, because they know that how the press is. Thomas Jefferson also said, "I will add that the man who never looks into a newspaper is better informed than he who reads them." There's a little saying, nobody knows exactly who really said it, but it says, to be informed, read the newspaper. To be misinformed, read the newspaper. So, before we go into crisis mode about some things, you got to be sure there really is a crisis that's needed. The crisis of President Trump or Hillary Clinton. Here's a crisis for you. We are faced with that. Trump, Clinton, or vote for someone no one's ever heard of. One of the issues that came up in the election of 2016, which is what makes you think about conservatism in this light, was the old Christian conservative standbys called morality and character. Now, when I was a kid, Bill Clinton became president. I don't know when he became 1992? Does anybody know? 1992 became president. Jack Parchman was preaching a revival meeting for my father that week in November. And I remember being up late watching the reviews. And when they announced that night that Wild Bill had won, my dad snapped his recliner up and said, "Well, they're going to be here for our guns and Bibles before the year's out." I remember thinking, They ain't getting my gun. They can have my gun when they do what? When they pry it from my cold, dead hand, they can have my gun. I'm just a kid, you know? I don't really know. But I knew that when Bill Clinton was elected, everyone I knew said this for 8 years. Bill's immoral and he's ruining America. Hillary is really driving the train. He just does what she says. When I was a kid, we'd go to revival meetings and camp meetings, and people would say, I want to show you the verse of Scripture the Lord has given me about President Bill Clinton. Let his days be few when another take his office. Mm-hmm. And that was a prophecy about Judas Iscariot. Bill Clinton was the bad man. Everyone I knew was in favor of his impeachment for his sex scandal with Monica Lewinsky. With his wife, we had the shady business dealings of the Rose Law Firm. I can remember Limbaugh had a parody song about Mrs. Clinton. And it was, Dear Mrs. Clinton, try to remember way back in September when you were a member of Rose Law Firm. Try to remember way back in September when you were a member of Rose Law Firm and worked wide water. And had a whole thing by her where she'd go, I don't know. Just it's scandals on every day. Every hand. It was a great day to time to be alive, I guess. If you listen to Rush Limbaugh, it was. We had the scandals around him and her, both from their Arkansas days, are still talked about by critics. When I was in Arkansas last week with Valerie, when her mom was put back in the hospital, I went to Goodwill. I go to Goodwill in Benton all the time. Benton's kind of an affluent place. They have cool stuff at Goodwill. So I went to Goodwill. I'm looking around. And they had the book section. And there's Bill Clinton's biography, My Life, by Bill Clinton. Anybody read it? Read it. It's cool. I read it when we lived in Hope. Because Hope is where Bill Clinton was born. That's where I lived. I pastored Bill Clinton's first cousin for a while. And that was fun. And so I'm standing there. And there's these two. There's a Goodwill employee and a Goodwill patron besides myself standing there. And she's looking at the books. And she goes, Oh, Bill Clinton. Oh, I can't, but and he was like, yeah, I know. Can you believe he's from our state? And they just, here we are, lots of years past Bill Clinton, and they're still talking about him like he was the worst thing. In fact, I found this out. I bet nobody knows it. The patron, she said one of her best friends used to date Bill Clinton. And the stories she could tell, I'm telling you. Yeah, that's what I learned at Goodwill in Arkansas. I say that people are still talking about what a dog he was, you know, in places like that. So the Christians, you know, of the time were all about getting rid of him. In the vitriol that I heard as a teenager for the first 4 years of the Clinton presidency, I actually had this thought that if I ever got a chance to kill the president, that I would be a national hero. I'd be saving the nation. Because of the rhetoric that I was hearing, that it's that big of a deal. I mean, they're coming for the Bible, they're coming for the guns, they're selling our soul to the UN. I mean, I was getting stirred up. You know, as a young person, you don't always have good judgment. Lots of passion, but you don't always have good judgment. Here I am, I'm a kid, I like guns and like shooting stuff, and I was thinking, well, I'd be a hero, I'd save the country. And I'm sure that the preachers who I heard say stuff like that, or other Christians I heard who talked about Clinton, I'm sure that they would have been very upset that I had that thinking, but I don't take responsibility for my actions. It was their fault. They were saying it to me. I was impressionable. I'm innocent, Your Honor. You know how it goes. And then we had, after Clinton, we got through without any loss of guns or Bibles and all that kind of thing. Then we had 16 years of Bush Part II and then Obama. Neither person was very impressive. Other than the election of them both were notable. In Bush, it was the first time the first son of a former president to be elected since John Adams and his son, John Quincy Adams. And Obama was notable because he was the first African-American president to be elected. And under both persons, Bush and Obama, we saw the limitation of our rights as Americans, because both persons took the view that the government was the savior of mankind. And albeit some of Bush's behaviors in restricting individual freedoms of Americans or intruding into our private affairs was kicked forwards or spurred on by the war on terror. Because, friends, when 9/11 happened, it got wild. I mean, it was a crazy time. America, we'd never been attacked on this soil before. What's going to happen? I worked at Mountain Valley Water in Hot Springs, Arkansas, and here's what I was getting. We were bottling water. My boss came by. We just got the fillers running, and sometimes they're kind of cranky. We just got them going good, and the boss comes out and says, "We're shutting down and sending you guys home." My first thought was, we're all fired, right? We're all getting fired. He said, "No, the Russians." Andre, cover your ears. "The Russians have bombed D.C. Everything's on fire in Washington, D.C. The Russian, one of my friends came and said, "You got a gun?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Go to buy some more bullets. We're going to need them." And so, man, at that time, I had a 1976 Chevy Impala, and I figured I can make it home. I can bust through any roadblocks that are set up along the way. And I go to the break room, and I call Valerie, and I say, "Hey, turn on the TV. They're sending us home." She turns on the TV. We come to find out that the Russians had not attacked us. Thank the Lord for that. And it was a terrorist attack, and then I listened to the radio. Then all day long, you know, everybody was trying to get their senses. And so some of the stuff that took place in the aftermath of that was based on just natural reaction to attacks. But that's what was happening. So anything that Bush did, some of the stuff that he was forced to do, he felt like he had to defend the country. And if you read anything about his, or listen to interviews about it, you kind of get his mind about that. That everything else shifted just to protect in America. Everything else became secondary to being safe. And I think that's probably how most people would react. And in 2016, we had a contest for the presidency between the wife of former President Bill Clinton and Donald Trump. The Trump was the nominee of who? Republicans, which are also what's? Conservatives, and a lot of those are what's? Christians. Trump, the nominee of conservatives and Christians. Hillary, the nominee of Democrats, liberals, and others. In her, we had a woman devoted to power and whatever it takes to get it. And in him, we had a man devoted to building a financial empire. That sums up both persons, I think, pretty well. One who wants power and one who wants to be wealthy. In itself, the desire to be powerful or wealthy probably are not bad things. Just in that, when you go, either way, what you're devoted to, you are willing to do whatever it takes to succeed. And I think both persons, I think that's true of both people. The morals of both persons, Hillary or Donald, if we're going to make a moral decision, who's the more moral of the two? Who's the more moral of the two? Woo-hoo. The record, if you look at the record of each person on any political thing, long term or short term, the record of each, what do you say about it? It's shaky. Like all politicians, both Hillary and Donald promised us what? A better future. Elect me, and you have a better future. That's what all politicians say, isn't it? That's what they have to say. If they told you, "Hey, I'm going to make it worse," who's going to vote for him? Mitchell says, "I might. I'd like to see worse." Can it happen? So who do you vote for as a Christian in that situation? You vote for Clinton, you vote for Trump. How do you decide? In conservative evangelical circles, listen to this, in conservative evangelical circles, some people, I heard, famous evangelical pastor, not that famous to you guys, but somebody who's a talking head out there in evangelical circles, he said, "Vote for Hillary." Others said, "Vote for anyone else, but don't vote for either Hillary or Trump." Some people said, "A Christian who votes for Trump invalidates his claim to care about a person's morals." He said, "To vote for Trump invalidates any claim that you have to believe in morals or character." Now, that kind of talk puts an American Christian in a rough place. So we come back to conservatism. Can I vote for a conservative leader who is not really a Christian? Can I vote for a person who is pro-America, loves America, and is concerned for the state of the country, but who is just not let me reread here, and is concerned for the state of the country, but who is not just a Christian, who's not a Christian, he's not just not a Christian, but someone whom we view with about as much respect as any actor from Hollywood. Now, what are you going to do as a Christian? Trump made an appeal to Christians to support him for the presidency, and did they do it? Yeah, he wouldn't be there if they hadn't done it. But how could they do it? I sent this paper to a couple of my friends before I stopped right there with, but how could they do it? One of my friends wrote back and said, that's the best ending I've ever heard. How could they? And I said, no, you don't understand. It's not, the paper's not done. It's not like, how could they do that? How dare you? No, it's, how could they do it? Why did Christians do it? Why did I, Terry Basham, vote for Donald Trump for president? I did. I voted for him in the primary. I voted for him on Facebook. I voted for him with my friends because my friends were saying, don't support him at all. He's bad news. I defended him. I tried to make good arguments to say he's the guy we should have. I voted for him in the election. Why did I do that? Christian pastor votes for owner of strip club for president. Think of that. Because that's a true thing. It's a true thing. How can you do that? Well, I'll give you a few reasons. One, he at least in principle opposed abortion. He at least in principle opposed abortion. All Republicans oppose abortion in principle. Do Republicans really get their hind ends in gear and do something about it? Like defunding Planned Parenthood? Not really. But at least in principle, they're opposed to it. Trump's a nationalist, not a globalist. Some people say, how can you as a Christian not care about other countries? Well, as a Christian, I care about other countries in the sense of the gospel, but I'm still an American. I want my country to do well, because if my country does well, the gospel flows out from our country. Our country does not do well, the gospel does not flow from this country. So it's just, he's a nationalist, not a globalist. It doesn't seem to me that the only one world government we should be looking forward to is the one that's a one world government that's overseen by Jesus Christ, not whoever the United Nations would elect or somebody like that. Number three, Trump had a better view of the economics of America, a better view of economic issues, again, because of nationalism versus globalism. Number five, many Americans, because like many Americans, generally persons over 40, they like the politically incorrect manner that Trump carried himself with, where he said whatever he said, and if you didn't like it, in the words of my father, tough toenails. There's something about that that people like. Somebody just says what it is, doesn't worry about it. Number five, last but not least, because he was not Hillary, and only he could defeat her. I didn't see anybody else in the candidate that I thought in the Republican Party that could beat her. And I wasn't the only one that thought that. He got the nomination from the Republicans, from the conservatives. Now what I find fascinating at this point, what I find fascinating is that even now, evangelicals who said don't vote for Trump are glad it's Trump and not Hillary. Even those who said don't vote for him, anybody but him, even the never-Trumpers or no-Trumpers are all happy that it's Trump and not Hillary. Because if we had Hillary, well, we all know what it'd be like. It'd be like when we had Bill, right? They're going to come to get what? Our guns and our Bibles, right? He's better than her. So in the conclusion, one of my friends pointed out to me, I sent this paper to several of my preacher friends and said, what do you guys think about it? Because I want to see what they said. If I missed anything, if they disagreed with it. One of my friends pointed out that the founding documents of our nation are designed and work well for a Christian-ish nation. A Christian-ish nation. And that Donald Trump and people like him are Christian-ish enough to make it work. Christian-ish enough. And I think this is true. Because a nation of free people who are led by the light of the Holy Scriptures will be a great country. But a free people who are led by darkened hearts, deadened sins, will be an insane country. And what we're seeing in our country is a shift away from a sensible government with sensible ideals that make sense and are rational and helpful and moral are being replaced day by day by an insanity that's prevailing. We see it more and more with every passing day. The behavior of our citizenry causes the people of the nation to consider removing rights we hold dear by behaviors. Now, what I mean by that is you see a wholesale assault on some of our rights as citizens. I will be done at 3 o'clock, I promise. I only have 12 more pages to read to you. I'm just teasing about that. Here are some examples. How many of you are familiar with the First Amendment? Now, what is that? It's the what? It's the freedom of speech, the press. We like that, right? We like that. Here, I'll read it to you. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. That's the First Amendment. We like it. However, after being lied to by the media by means of the artful omission or skillful editing, we begin to say, what about the press? It's all what? The president says it all the time. It's what? Fake news. Fake news. How many of you like to get rid of fake news? I'm not getting rid of fake news. I just want to hear the truth, right? I just want to hear true news. True news. How do we do that? How do we get rid of fake news? There's only one way to do it. Regulate the press. Regulate your freedom of speech. And people, and now I've said this before, I'll say it to you guys again, like about Islam. How many of you like freedom of religion? How many of you like to see Islam outlawed in America? I raise my hand. I like to see it outlawed. But I want freedom of religion. And I got to keep in mind that if they outlaw Islam, they might outlaw sovereign grace, independent, fundamental, King James Baptist people like me. But because of their behavior, it makes me entertain the thought of giving up a freedom. You see what I'm saying? The behavior of our citizenry causes us to consider giving up some of these freedoms. After watching the protest of last year over racism and the election of the president by Antifa and people of that ilk, we begin to say we need a law against protest. We need to do something about this. But one of our very rights as a nation is the freedom to what? It's the freedom to assemble and protest the behaviors of the government. But the behavior of our citizenry as we drift more and more away from a biblical worldview and Christian principles and that kind of thing, of right thinking, we begin to consider removing some of the rights we hold dear. The Second Amendment is after the First Amendment. That's profound, isn't it? The right to bear arms. A well-regulated militia, this is the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, when we see people who have legally obtained firearms go into schools, malls, and movie theaters, and churches, and shoot people, it causes us to begin to think, what? We got to do something about the guns. We got to do something about all these guns. We got to do something. You begin to think that. You say, well, I don't think that. Well, it's because you got what we call common sense, probably. But in the hearts of people, when it's happening, you begin to think, well, if we take it away, take it away. Take away the guns. The threat of harm. That's what one effect it has on people. We've got to get rid of the guns. And then on the other side, you have the threat of harm, which also causes us to say things like this. Let's give everybody a gun. That way, in case it goes south, everybody gets an even break. So think of it like this. If all the kids at the school in Texas last week, if every one of them was packing heat, and one kid goes in there and throws down on somebody, Well, people are going to get killed. I mean, the real stories of the Old West were this, is that the most dangerous place to be in a gunfight when those guys were whipping their guns out and shooting each other, the most dangerous place to be was anywhere around. Remember on the old Westerns when the guys walk out in the street, they're going to face off, the women and children, everybody runs for cover? That's because those guys were not good shots. Most of the time they're drunk and had bad eyesight. Look up and read Guns and Ammo's little book. It's a big book with pictures of dead bodies in it called Gunfighters of the Old West, and see pictures of people who were killed accidentally in gunfights. I mean, but we see what the behavior of the citizenry, bad behavior, causes us to rethink these rights. Either people say, get rid of all the guns, or let's arm everybody. Now think about that. Arming everybody, that sounds, you know, like, okay. On one level, yeah, it's a good idea. But where is that going to stop? We got Matt. Matt, you got any guns? You want a gun? Would you like to have a gun?
Yes,
he would. What kind of gun are we going to give Matt? Muzzleloader? Think about a whole school of, Matt, what grade are you in? Second or third grade?
Second
grade? Second graders with guns? Well, there's probably no way to be down for that. Let's give 13-year-olds guns. But Billy's like, oh. I was 9 when I got my first gun. 9. And that was April. October, I was out in the woods by myself hunting with that same gun. Accidentally, I almost shot my brother the same year, too, for the first time. Guns to everybody? Or what? But to see, the behavior causes us to think about things in different ways. You know, recently here in Oklahoma, they gave a bill to the governor to give everybody the right to concealed carry, constitutional carry in Oklahoma. I have a concealed carry license. I had to pay for it, go to class for it. And I was disappointed that she signed the bill to take it away. I was disappointed. Do you want to carry a gun? Carry one. That's what the law says. Anyway, I'm getting off on the side stuff. The Fourth Amendment is one we are all familiar with. We don't really know it, probably. It's protection from unreasonable searches and seizures. Now, this right actually was hung up on was given up during the War on Terror, where the government had the right now to, they're listening to our conversations. They'd check the mail in your mailbox if they could. In fact, I'm not so sure the government is not reading your mail right now because of this. The Postal Service now offers a service where you can know what letters are coming into your mailbox the night before you get them. They'll email you a list of everything coming in your mail. Isn't that wild? They'll send it to you. They're scanning it. It's got your address on it. It's in their big box. They're in their big computers. They never a piece of mail you got in the last 10 years, probably. And you'll say, well, they would never read it. I'd think twice about that. Now I'm going to conspiracy theory mode. The Fourth Amendment. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, and papers and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause. Probable cause means a very good reason to do it, supported by an oath or an affirmation of the officials that's supplied, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Now, because of a desire to be safe from acts of terror, it's caused Americans to be willing to sacrifice our right to privacy in exchange for the illusion of safety. Let's give the government access to everything we know and everything we have as long as we can be safe. The behavior of the citizenry causes us to think about giving up rights. Another friend of mine, he said that America's drift from the authority of scriptures is seen directly in our drift from the authority of the Constitution. As we drift away from the scriptures as our authority, as our paper king, we drift away from the Constitution. Which brings us to kind of a closing thought. What can be done? What can be done? Well, churches have to continue to hold the line and preach the gospel. The churches must continue to warn their communities, even when it's unpopular, that the wages of sin is death. Death of the soul and death of the culture. Death of the soul and death of the culture. When people live in sin, it will ruin the culture. It ruins the culture. We Christians are the salt and the light. And we need to remember that both salt and light, when you get up in the morning, let's say tomorrow morning, brothers, you're laying in bed and the alarm clock gets off and your wife, like all good wives, goes out to get you your pipe and slippers and turn on the coffee pot. Amen? You're laying there in the bed. She comes in with your stuff. She flips on the light. Wakes you up asleep. What's your response to that light? Shut it off. I mean, the light at first is irritating, isn't it? Christians who shine the light of God's word, it's going to irritate the world. Nothing to do about it. Have you ever been, you got a cut on your hand? Has everybody got hand sanitizer in the church? Everybody got hand sanitizer poked in your purse? Probably the ladies all do. And they got their hand sanitizer, and she's like, Valerie's like, you want some hand sanitizer? And she squirts some on there. And I rub it on my hand, and then it becomes very, and then I remember all the little cuts I have in my hand. And you're like, ooh, that hurts. It irritates. Salt is the same kind of thing. It irritates. Salt and light irritate the world. The world doesn't like to be salted down or had the light of the gospel shine on it. It doesn't like it. It's irritating to them, but they need it. They need it. And this is what the churches have to do. We remember, we are salt and light. It irritates them at first, but the world will get used to it, and it makes a difference ultimately. As the gospel is more freely and widely preached, things go better. Which causes us to ask this question. In the age of the media, internet, and all that kind of thing, where the gospel is able to go forth in greater and greater ways, why isn't it making a difference in America? The gospel is really going out there in huge bits in ways it never could before. Why isn't it making a difference? I say to you, how do you know it's not making a difference? How do you know it's not? It is making a difference. Remember three things. Number one, we need to embrace reality as Christians. And that reality is that ultimately we as Christians, we're just passing through this world. We're sojourners here. Our citizenship is in heaven. We are here and we'll be gone, either through the Lord's return or through our own deaths. It's a reality. The world around us is going to go to pieces. We also need to remember the nations rise and fall. Nations rise and fall. And that our nation, America, is not immune. It's not immune to falling. Number three, every view of the coming of the Lord, except for post-millennialism, has him returning to a world that's gone crazy and out of control. So when it's really, really crazy out there in the world, remember that every eschatological picture has Christ coming back to a world gone mad. So as the world gets madder and madder around us, it's a reminder to us that he is coming. He is coming. And I pray the Lord will come soon. Let us pray together. Father, I pray that you'd help us to keep a few of these.